ランダンデンデンデンデンデンデンダンダンデンデンダンダンデンデン
Part 7 Feral
デンデンデンデンダンダンデンデンダンダンデンデンダンダンデンデンデンデンデンデンダンダンデンデンダンダンデンデン
Reticule 1. In Proto, Old, and Middle Earth, a small bag or basket, net-like in its construction. 2. In Early Praxic Earth, a grid-like network of lines or fine wires on an optical device. 3. In Later Praxic and New Earth, two or more syntactic devices that are able to communicate with one another. Reticulum. 1. When not capitalized, a reticule formed by the interconnection of two or more smaller reticules. 2. When capitalized, the largest reticulum, joining together the preponderance of all reticules in the world, sometimes abbreviated to ret. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
There was no point trying to talk Cord out of going with me. We just climbed into our fetch and started as soon as the picnic was over. We had to backtrack 30 miles to find a north-going road that would not peter out before the mountains. At the first town on that road, I used up my money card buying fuel, food, and warm clothes. Then I used up Fra Jad's. While we were loading the stuff into the fetch, Ganeliel Crade pulled up. Sitting next to him was Saman. Both were grinning, which was a novelty. They didn't have to announce that they were coming with us, and we didn't have to discuss it. They got busy buying the same sorts of things we had just bought. Crade had an ammunition can full of coins, and Saman had information in his G-jaw that worked in lieu of money. I got the sense that each of them had obtained funds from his respective community. I wasn't happy to see Crade again. If it really was true that he was getting money for this journey from the people of Sambal, it raised all sorts of questions as to what he was really up to. Crade had reinstated the three-wheeler in the back of his fetch, so he didn't have much room left over. Most of the bulky stuff went into Cord's fetch. We had no idea where we were going or what to plan for, but we all seemed to be carrying roughly the same picture in our heads, namely that Orlo had gone up into the mountains for some reason. It would be cold up there, and we might have to camp, so we got things like winter bed rolls, tents, stoves, and fuel. Saman had an idea that he might be able to track Orlo, and Crade was planning to make inquiries with some of his co-religionists along the way. We all climbed back into our vehicles and headed north. It would be 2 hours' drive to the foothills, where Crade knew of places to camp. He led the way. This was a thing he felt a compulsion to do, and I was tired of fighting it. Cord was content to follow. Crade, sitting upright at the controls, and Saman hunched over the glowing screen of his super Jija, gave us the feeling that the two of them must be seeing to all of the details. I wouldn't have been comfortable following either of them alone, but together they'd never agree on anything, so I judged it was prudent. I regretted parting from people like Arcibald and Leo, with whom I could talk about things. But once we turned north and started forging toward the mountains, the regret vanished, and instead I felt relief. So much had been revealed to me over the course of the last 24 hours, not only about the cousin's ship, but even more so about the world I had lived in for 10.5 years, that it was too much for me to make sense of in one go. Just to name one example, the thatched roofs on the nuclear waste cylinders alone, if I had learned of it in the consent, would have taken me a little getting used to. I was much more at ease sitting next to my Sib, staring out the windscreen, my sole responsibility being to chase a wild frog across the waste. The night before, at the Bayesian Monastery, I had accommodated certain new odd facts in my mind just by sleeping. A similar trick might work for me now. By doing something completely different for a few days, I might chance upon a better understanding than I could get by kneeling in a cell and concentrating on it, or having a wordy discussion in a chalk hall. And even if all of that was completely wrong, I didn't care. I simply needed a break. Cord spent a lot of time talking on the Jijaw with Rosk. She had kissed him goodbye on the Sambal Village Green. He had to go back home and work. Now there were issues of some kind to be worked out. They didn't have just one long conversation on the Jijaw. Instead, they made and broke contact 10 or so times. It got on my nerves, and I wished we'd get to some wild reach where her link wouldn't work. But after a while, I got used to it and started to wonder, if Rosk and Cord had to do so much communicating to rig for a few days' separation, what did that imply for me and Ayla? I couldn't stop recalling the shocked look on Tullia's face as we had pulled out yesterday afternoon, part of which, I was sure, came from that she thought I was being beastly to Ayla. Is there currently a mechanism in place for sending letters? I asked Cord during a breather between micro-conversations with Rosk. From here, it'll take some doing, but the answer is yes, she said. Then she got a big smile. You want to write to a girl, Raz? Since I had never mentioned Ayla to her and had asked my question in such a colorless way, I was shocked and then quite irritated that she had figured this out with no effort. She was still deriving joy from the look on my face when her Jijaw twittered and gave me a few minutes to get my composure back. Tell me about her, Cord demanded, as soon as she disconnected. Ayla, you met her. She's the one I remember, Ayla. I liked her. Really? That was not obvious to me. That and so many other things, Cord said in such an airy, innocent voice that it almost slipped by me. Then I had to spend a minute being silent and dignified. She and I have hated each other pretty much our whole lives, I said. Especially recently. Then we started something. It was pretty sudden. Really wonderful, though. Cord gave me a grateful smile and almost swerved off the road. The next day she was evoked. This was before we knew it was going to become a convox, so in effect she was dead to me after that. This was, I guess, pretty upsetting to me. I sort of put it out of my mind by working. Then when I got evoked yesterday, which seems like 10 years ago now, it opened up the possibility that I might see her again. But then a few hours later, I decided to make this little detour, which just turned into a bigger detour. As a matter of fact, I am technically a feral now, and so I might never see her again because of the way I just let Fraud Jad push me around. So you might say things are complicated. Hard to say just how long I'd have to spend on a Jijaw with her, sorting this one out. Cord took another call from Rosk then, and by the time she was finished, I was ready with more. Mind you, I'm not just whining about my own situation here. Everything's confused. This is the biggest upheaval since the third sack. So many weird things are going on. It almost makes a mockery of the discipline. But your way isn't just that set of rules, Cord said. It's who you are. You follow that way for bigger reasons. And as long as you stay true to that, the confusion you're talking about will sort itself out eventually. I would have been fine with that, except for one problem. It sounded like the mentality that Edharians were accused of having by people who believed in all of that lineage stuff that Kriskin had been telling us about. So an instinct told me to say nothing. Then Cord sprang the trap on me. And likewise, you could drive yourself crazy trying to sort through all of these ins and outs in your relationship with Ayla. But if you send her a letter, which is a great idea, you shouldn't get into all of that. Just skip it.
Skip it?
Yeah, just tell her how you feel.
I feel jerked around, that's how I feel.
You want me to say that?
No.
Tell her how you feel about her.
My gaze dropped to her Jijaw, sitting on the seat between us, silent for once.
Are you sure you haven't been taking calls from Tullia on that thing? Because I have the feeling you guys have your own private reticule, like the Ida?
This would have been insulting if I had said it, but she thought it was hilarious. We both looked up the road at the back of Saman's head, silhouetted against his Jijaw screen.
That's right, Cord said.
We're the girl Ida, and if you don't do what we say, we're going to throw the book at you. Cord had a notebook that she used as a maintenance log for her fetch, so I used a blank page to begin a letter to Ayla. This went about as badly as it was possible for a written document to go. I tore it out and started again. I couldn't get used to the way the disposable poly pen shat pasty ink onto the slick machine-made paper. I tore it out and started yet again.
I had to suspend work on the fourth draft because Gonelliel Crade had led us off the paved road and onto a dirt track better suited for his fetch than for Cord's. The lower south-facing slopes of the mountains were covered with fuel tree plantations and crisscrossed with dirt roads, such as this one, alive with rampaging log trucks, dusty and dangerous to us. We spent an unpleasant half hour getting through that zone. Then we climbed to where the growing season was too short and the grades too steep for that industry, or indeed for any kind of economic activity save recreation. He led us to a beautiful camping place at the edge of a tarn in the hills. People came here to hunt in the autumn, he said, but no one was here today. All of our equipment was new, and we had to take it out of boxes and dispose of the wrappers and tags and instruction manuals before we could do anything with it. We started a bonfire with these and sustained it with fallen dead timber. As the sun went down, this settled to a bed of coals on which we cooked cheeseburgs. Cord bedded down in her fetch, and the three men got ready to share a tent. I stayed up late and finished my letter to Ayla by firelight, which was a good way to do it. The seventh draft was short and simple. I just kept asking myself, if fate had it that we'd never see each other again, what would I need to say to her? The next day started out refreshingly devoid of great events, new people, and astonishing revelations. We got up slowly in the cold, lighted the stove, heated up some rations, and got on the road. Crade was happy. It was not in his nature to be that way, but he was happy here and now, strutting all over the place, telling us the best way to pack our bedrolls, and attending to every detail of the camp stove as if it were a nuclear reactor. But he was much easier to be around in such circumstances, where we actually had something to do with all of his energies. I decided that he was too intelligent for his circumstances and that he had missed an opportunity to be an avout. If he had been born among the Slines, he'd have ended up on a Consent. Instead, he had landed among a sect that valued his brains too much to let him go. But his brains had no purpose there. Anyway, he was used to being the only smart person within 100 miles, and now that he had been thrown together with other smart people, he didn't know how to behave. Saman was badly out of his element. He could hardly pick up anything on his Jija, but he managed well, as if prolonged suffering were a standard part of the Ida toolkit. He had a shoulder bag that was for him what Cord's vest was for her, and he kept pulling out useful tools and gadgets. Or so it seemed to me, as I was not used to owning things. Cord was quiet, unless I looked at her, whereupon she'd become grumpy. I was bored and impatient. When we finally got going again, I guessed it must be about midday, but according to the clock and Cord's fetch, midday was not for another 3 hours. We went up into the mountains. This was new to me. Any travel would have been new to me. When I'd been a kid, before I'd been collected, I'd left town a few times, tagging along on trips that my elders made to visit friends or kin in the near country. After I'd joined the Consent, of course, I hadn't traveled at all, and I hadn't missed it. I hadn't known what there was to miss. Up in those hills and mountains, seeing natural leads of open space through the forest, pale green meadows, old logging roads, abandoned fortresses, decrepit cabins, and collapsed palaces, I began to think of these as places I might go, if I had the time to stop and go for a walk. In that way, the landscape was altogether different from the Consent, all of whose paths had been trodden for thousands of years, and where going into the cellar of Shuf's Dalmont seemed intrepid. It made me wonder where my mind might ramble, and where events might take me, now that circumstances had forced me to leave the Consent and venture into such places. Cord changed the music. The popular songs she had been playing the previous days felt wrong here. Their beautiful parts did not stand comparison with what we could see out the windows, and their coarse parts jarred. She owned a recording of the music of the Consent, which we sold in the market outside the day gate alongside our honey and our mead. She started playing random selections from it, beginning with a lament for the third sack. To Cord, this was just selection number 37. To me, it was just about the most powerful piece of music we had. We sang it only once a year at the end of a week spent fasting and reciting the names of the dead and the titles of the books burned. Somehow the feeling was right. if the cousins turned out to be hostile, they might sack the world. We came around a turn and were confronted by a wall of purple stone that went up until it disappeared in a cloud layer a mile above our heads. It must have stood there for a million years. Seeing it while I heard the lament, I felt what I can only describe as patriotism for my planet. Until this moment in history, there had never been any call for such feelings because there had never been anything beyond Arb except for points of light in the sky. Now that had changed, and instead of thinking of myself as a member of the Provener team or of the Decenarian Math or of the Edharian Order, I felt like a citizen of the world, and I was proud to be doing my little bit to protect it. I was comfortable being a feral. Casinos and spielies weren't the only new experiences you had when you went extramuros. Even if you traveled solo and stuck to the wild places, even if you never saw a strip mall or heard a word of Fluckish, you were getting information, not about the secular world, but about the world that had been there before it. The ground state that cultures and civilizations emerged from and collapsed back into. The wellsprings of the secular, but also of the mathic world. The origin where, 7,000 years ago, those worlds had diverged.
Sea of Seas. A relatively small but complex body of salt water, connected to Arb's great oceans in three places by straits and generally viewed as the cradle of classical civilization. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
We crested the pass and descended into a small city, Norslof. This took me by surprise. I'd seen the Cartabla, but in the fantasy map of the world that I carried in my head, the mountains went on for much farther. We had not found Orlo, but we had at least made one pass over the landscape. Along the way, we had taken note of a few places where he might have gone. Most promising of these, to my mind, had been a small, tatterdemalion math constructed on a lookout tower originally put there to detect forest fires. It was a few miles off the road and a few thousand feet above it. We had noticed it shortly after topping the pass. If it had been a full-sized consent, they wouldn't have wanted anything to do with someone like Orlo. But such an out-of-the-way math might have welcomed an Orth-speaking wanderer who could bring them some new ideas. We stopped to eat and use toilets at a big Drummond refueling station several miles outside of Norslof's commercial center. Here it was possible to rent rooms, and it was permissible to sleep in one's vehicle. I had an idea that we might use it as a base from which to double back into the mountains and search for Orlo. I changed my mind when we walked into the mess hall, steamy and redolent of cured meats, and all of the long-range Drummond operators turned to stare at us. It was obvious that they didn't get many customers such as us and that they preferred it that way. Part of it must have been that we were a group of four in a room full of singletons. But even if we had come in one by one, we would have drawn stares. Saman was dressed in normal-looking extramuros garb, but his long beard and hair were not the norm, and the bone structure of his face marked him ethnically. The men in this room would not be able to peg him as Eta, supposing they even knew what the Eta were, but they could tell he was not one of them. Cord did not dress or move like their women. Her repertoire of gestures and facial expressions was altogether disjoint from theirs. Ganeliel, being an extra, ought to have blended, but somehow didn't. He belonged to a religious community that went to great lengths to preserve its apartness from the cultural baseline, and he proclaimed as much in the way he carried himself and the looks he gave people. And I? I had no idea how I looked. Since leaving the consent, I'd spent most of my time among extras who knew that I was an avowed on Peregrine. Here I was trying to pass for something I wasn't, and it seemed best to assume I was doing a terrible job of it. We might have drawn even more attention had it not been for the fact that there were spielies all over the place. They were mounted to the ceiling, angled down toward the tables. All of them ran the same feed in lockstep. At the moment we walked in the door, this showed a house burning down at night. It was surrounded by emergency workers. A close-up showed a woman leaning out of an upper-story window that was vomiting black smoke. She had a towel wrapped around her face. She dropped a baby. I kept watching to see what happened next, but instead the Spiele cycled back and showed the baby drop two more times in slow motion. Then that scene vanished and was replaced by images of a ball player making a clever play. But then it showed the same ball player breaking his leg later in the game. This, too, was repeated several times in slow motion so that you could see the leg bending at the sight of the break. By the time we reached our table, the Spieles were showing an extraordinarily beautiful man in expensive clothes being arrested by police. My companions glanced at the images from time to time, then looked away. It seemed that they had built up some kind of immunity. I couldn't keep my eyes off of them, so I tried to sit in a position where there wasn't a Spiele directly in front of me. Still, every time the feed popped from one image to another, my eye jumped to it. I was like an ape in a tree, looking at whatever moved fastest in my environment. We sat in the corner, ordered food, and talked quietly. The room, which had gone silent when we had entered, slowly defrosted and was replenished by the normal low murmur of conversation. It occurred to me that we should not have chosen a corner table because this would make it impossible for us to get out quickly if there was some kind of trouble. I missed Leo badly. He would have assessed the threats, if any, and thought about how to counter them. And he might have gotten it completely wrong, as he had with Estimard and his sidearm. But at least he would have taken care of these matters so that I could worry about other things. Take Saman as an example. When he had joined us, I'd been glad of his company, as he knew how to do so many things that I didn't, which was all fine when it was just four of us camped by a tarn. But now that we were deep in the secular world, I recalled the ancient taboo against contact between Avout and Ida, which we could not have been breaking any more flagrantly. Did these people know of that taboo? If so, did they understand why it had been instated? Were we, in other words, stirring memories and awakening fears of old? Would their police protect us from a mob? Or join in with them? Ganeliel Crade started canvassing his local brethren on his Jija. This grew obnoxious, and when he noticed that we were all glaring at him, he got up and moved to an empty table. I asked Saman if he could pull up any information on the lookout tower map, and he began to view maps and satellite photos on his Jija that were much better than the stored charts on the Cartabla. I'd rarely seen anything like these pictures, which must have been very like what the cousins could see of Arb from their ship. This answered a question that had been rattling around in my head since yesterday morning. "Hey," I said, "I think Orlo was looking at such pictures. He put a few up on the wall of his cell."
"It's too bad you didn't tell me that before," said Saman curtly.
Not for the first time I got the feeling that we Avout were children and the Ita, far from being a subservient caste, were our minders. I was about to apologize. Then I got the feeling that once I started apologizing, I'd never be able to stop. Somehow I managed to arrest my embarrassment before it reached the mud on the head stage. On the Spiele, an old building being blown up, people celebrating. "Okay, well, now that you mention it, Fra Jad went out of his way to make sure I came away with him," I said, and pulled from my shirt pocket the folded-up phototypes of the big hole in the ground. I spread them out on the table. Three heads converged and bent over them. Even Ganeliel Crade, who had taken to pacing back and forth as he yammered on his Jija, slowed down for a look-see, but no light of recognition came into his face.
"That looks like a mine, probably in the tundra," he said, just to be saying something.
"The sun is shining almost straight down into it," I pointed out.
"So?"
"So it can't be at a high latitude." Now it was Crade's turn to be embarrassed. He turned away and pretended to be extremely involved in his Jija conversation. On the Spiele, phototypes of a kidnapped child, blurry footage of the kid being led out of a casino by a man in a big hat. "I was wondering," I said to Saman, "if you could, I don't know, use your Jija to start scanning the globe and look for such features. I know it would be like finding a needle in a haystack, but if we were systematic about it and if we worked in shifts for long enough..." Saman responded to my idea in much the same spirit as I had to Crade's suggestion that this thing was in the tundra. He held his Jija up above the picture and took a phototype of the phototype. Then he spent a few seconds interacting with the machine. Then he showed me what had come up on its screen, a different picture of the same hole in the ground, except now it was a live feed from the reticulum.
"You found it,"
I said, because I wanted to go slowly and make sure I understood what was going on.
A syntactic program available on the reticulum found it,
he corrected me.
It turns out to be a long way from here, on an island in the Sea of Seas.
Can you tell me the name of the island?
Ekba.
Ekba? I exclaimed. Is there a way to figure out what it is? Cord asked. Saman zoomed in, but this was almost unnecessary. Now that I knew it was on Ekba, I was no longer inclined to see this hole as an open-pit mine. It was clearly an excavation. It was completely encircled by mounded-up earth that had been taken out of it, and a ramp spiraled around to its flat bottom. But it was too orderly, too prim for a mine. Its flat bottom was neatly gridded. It is an archaeological dig, I said, a huge one. What's there on Ekba to dig up? Cord asked.
I can search for that,
Saman said, and got ready to do so. Wait, zoom out. Again, and again, I asked him. We could now see the dig as a pale scar several miles south-southeast of a huge solitary mountain that ramped up out of a wrinkled sea. The upper slopes of the mountain were patched with snow, but its summit had a scoop taken out of it, a caldera. That is Orathena, I said. The mountain? Cord asked. No, the dig, I said. Someone has been digging up the Temple of Orathena. It was buried by an eruption in -2621. Who'd do that and why? Cord asked. Saman zoomed back in. Now that I knew what to look for, I could see that the whole dig was surrounded by a wall. It was pierced in one place by a gate. Inside, several structures had been erected around a rectangular courtyard. A cloister. A tower sprouted from one of these. It's a math, I said. Come to think of it, I once heard a story, probably from Archibald, that some order had gone to Ekba and started trying to dig their way down to the Temple of Orathena. I thought it was just a few eccentric frauds with shovels and wheelbarrows, though.
I don't see any heavy equipment on the site, Craig pointed out. A few people with shovels could dig a hole that deep if they kept at it long enough.
This left me a little irritated, since it ought to have been obvious to me. After all, our minster had been constructed in the same style. But Craig was right, and there was nothing I could do but agree as vigorously as I could so that he wouldn't explain this any further.
This is all very interesting, Saman said, but is probably a dead end for us.
I agree, I said. Ekba was on another continent, or to be precise, it was in the Sea of Seas, which lay among four continents on the opposite side of the world.
Orla was not in the mountains, Ganeliel
Craig announced, pocketing his jijah.
He passed through here and kept right on going.
On the Spili, two very beautiful people getting married.
How do you know this? Saman asked.
I was glad of it. Craig was so sure of himself that I found it draining to confront him with even simple questions. Saman seemed to derive wicked pleasure from doing so. Craig rose to it.
He got a ride as far as here from some sample folk who were going this way and stayed the night before last in the back of my cousin's fetch, just a couple of miles from here.
The back of his fetch?
Doesn't your cousin have a spare bed?
Saman asked.
Yelassitar travels a lot, Craig answered. The back of his fetch is nicer than his house.
You say this happened the night before last? I asked. I had no idea we were so hot on his trail.
Getting colder every minute. Yelassitar helped him get outfitted yesterday morning, and then Orlo hitched a ride on a northbound Drummond.
Outfitted how? Cord asked.
With warm clothes, Craig said. The warmest clothes. This is something Yul knows a lot about. It's what he does for a living. I'm sure that's why Orlo sought him out in Norslof.
Why would Orlo want to keep going north? I asked. There's nothing there, am I right? Saman pawed at my cartabla, which had a larger display than his jija, zoomed way out and slewed it north and east.
Practically nothing but taiga, tundra, and ice between here and the North Pole. As far as economic activity is concerned, there are fuel tree plantations for the first couple of 100 miles. Beyond that, nothing but a few resource extraction camps.
The view on the cartabla seemed to contradict him, as it was densely netted with roads that came together at named places, many of which were ringed by concentric beltways.
but all of these were depicted in the faint brown color used to denote ruins. On the Spili, a fiery rocket launch from an equatorial swamp.
"Orlo's going to Ekba," Cord proclaimed.
"What are you talking about?" Crade demanded.
"Ekba is not on this continent. You have to fly," I said.
"He's going over the pole," she explained. "He's headed for the sledge port at 83 North.
We were in the habit of referring to the secular power as if it were one thing down through the ages. This seemed simple-minded or even insulting to some extras, though they did essentially the same thing when they spoke of the powers that be. Of course, we knew it was an oversimplification, but for us it was a useful convenience. Whatever empire, republic, despotate, papacy, anarchy, or depopulated wasteland lay beyond our walls at a given moment, we could slap this name on it and predicate certain things of it. What you are reading does not attempt to set forth details as to how the secular power was constituted in my day. Such information can be had anywhere. It might even be interesting if you know nothing about the history of the world up to the terrible events. But if you have studied that, everything since will seem like repetition, and all the particulars as to how the secular power of my day was organized will remind you of more or less ancient forerunners, but with less majesty and clarity, since the ancients were all doing it for the first time and believed they were onto something. But at this point, I had to attend to one of those details. The secular power in my day was a federation. It broke down into political units that more or less agreed with Arbor's continents. One could travel freely within most of those units, but to cross from one to another, one had to have documents. The documents were not that difficult to obtain, unless one was avowed. Since the reconstitution, we had existed wholly apart from the legal system of the secular power. They had no records of us, no jurisdiction over us, no responsibility for us. They could not draft us into their armies, levy taxes on us, or even step through our gates except at Appert. Likewise, they would not offer us assistance of any kind, except for protecting us from direct assault by mobs or armies, if they felt like it. We didn't get pensions or medical care from the secular power, and we certainly didn't get identity documents. It has become obvious during the writing of this that it might one day be read by people from other worlds. So I'll say that we considered ourselves to have 10 continents, but that the cousins, or anyone else who came to us from beyond and looked at Arb afresh, would have said we had only 7, and they would have been right. We counted ours as 10 because the original tally had been made by explorers working outwards from the Sea of Seas, who could only guess at what might lay more than a few days' march from its convoluted shores. It happened more than once that they bestowed distinct names on lands that were sundered by straits and gulfs, but that on further and much later exploration proved to be lobes of the same great landmass reaching toward the Sea of Seas from different quarters. But by that time the places had made their way into the classical myths and histories under the ancient names, which we could no more dislodge from the culture than we could withdraw one of the colossal foundation stones that supported the Minster. Likewise, during the rebirth, land had been found on the other side of the world from the Sea of Seas and had been proclaimed and mapped as a new continent. But centuries later it had been determined that the far northern reaches of that continent wrapped over the North Pole and thence extended south all the way to the Sea of Seas. It was not a new continent at all, but a limb of the oldest and best-known continent, and no one had ever had a clue about it, because even the aboriginal peoples who knew how to live in ice houses could not venture much above 80 degrees of latitude. To prove that the old and new continents were one, it was necessary to go all the way up to 90 degrees north latitude, the North Pole, and then descend to 80 or less on the other side. This had not been accomplished until the last century before the terrible events, and it had not changed people's habit of referring to the place that Cord, Saman, Ganeliel Crade, and I were on now, and the landmass forming the northern boundary of the Sea of Seas, as two different continents. The ice cap separated the two even more absolutely than an ocean would have, and no normal person ever traveled between them that way. They flew in an aircraft, or did it in a ship. But to do it by aircraft or ship, you'd have to pass through ports of entry and show documents. Orlo had none, and no hope of getting any. So he was doing what was logical, which was to exploit the fact that the two continents were in fact one. Cord had been the first to put this whole picture together in her mind. No, she'd been the second. The first had been Fra Jad.
"The sledge trains. That's like something out of a children's storybook to me," Simon said. "Do they still operate?"
"They were shut down for a while, but they are running again now," Crate confirmed. "The price of metals went up. People went back to stripping the deep ruins."
"We used to make parts for the sledge locomotives in the machine hall where I worked," Cord said. "We were the largest machine hall that was so far north, so they'd send the jobs to us. It's been a source of business for that shop for over 1,000 years. We had to make them of special alloys that wouldn't shatter in the cold."
And she went on in this vein for a minute or two. She could talk about alloys the way some girls talked about shoes. Crade and Saman, who'd been so fascinated to hear about the sledge train idea at first, got less and less so the more Cord said about it. In my mind, I was replaying the memory of Fra Jad in Orlo's cell yesterday. He couldn't have spent more than half a minute gazing at these phototypes before he had figured it all out. Even if you were the kind of person who attributed nearly supernatural powers to the Thousanders, this seemed a little weird. He must have had some prior knowledge about this.
"This excavation," I said, tapping my finger on the phototype.
Everyone looked at me funny. I realized that I had just interrupted Cord's disquisition about alloys. On the Spiele, victims of a roadside massacre, their hysterical wives rending their clothes and rolling on the ground. I continued, "I'll bet you my last energy bar that if you look it up, you'll find that it is 690 years old.
"You think they started digging this hole in 3,000?
Said Ganeliel Crade.
"Why? You like round numbers?"
This was an extremely rare attempt by Crade to make a joke, and so etiquette required me to smirk at it for a moment before I answered.
"I'm pretty sure Fra Jad knew that this was going on. He recognized this as soon as he saw it. So I'm thinking that this dig must have been launched during the most recent millennial convox. The Thousander math at Sant Edhar would have sent delegates to that convox, and so they would have heard about it and brought the knowledge back home with them, which is how Fra Jad knew."
Saman, as usual, was ready to play devil's advocate.
"I'm not disagreeing. But if you're right, it seems strange to me that Fra Jad could take one look at this phototype and know that it was the Orathena dig. It could be any hole in the ground. There's nothing to peg it to Ekba."
Until now, we had been attending mostly to the phototype that showed the entire dig on one sheet. The others were zoomed-in detail shots that hadn't made much sense before. Scanning them now, I was able to perceive the outlines of ancient building foundations, the stubs of columns, and flat areas of tiled floor. One of these was marked in a particular way. I pointed to it. "That's the analemma," I said. "The Temple of Orathena was a big camera obscura. It had a small hole in the roof that projected an image of the sun on the floor. As the seasons changed, the sunspot hit the floor in a different place each day during their midday ritual. What we celebrate now as Provener. Over the course of the year, it would trace this pattern on the floor."
"So you think Fra Jad noticed the analemma on this phototype and said to himself, 'Aha, this must be the Temple of Orathena'?"
"That seems like pretty quick thinking to me," Cord said.
"Well, he's a pretty smart guy,"
I returned. This was not the most polite answer. Jessery would have plained me at this point. Cord was right to be skeptical about it. I wasn't willing to dig any deeper on this point, though. The speed with which Fra Jad had recognized this hole in the ground suggested that he, and presumably the other millenarians, knew a lot about it. I was worried that if we pulled any harder on this loose thread, it would lead us back to crazy talk about the lineage.
"Oh, how interesting," Saman said,
gazing into his gee-jaw.
"Erasmus wins his bet. This dig in the phototypes was started in AR 3000.
He read another tidbit off the screen, then looked up and grinned at me.
"It was started by Edharians."
"Great," I muttered, wishing I could take Simon's gee-jaw and drop it down a toilet.
"It's a spin-off of Sant Edhar, but a lot of other Adharian mouths around the world contributed fraas and sewers to get it started.
How many have outlived there? Cord asked.
I could see her doing the calculation in her head. If each of out moves 20 wheelbarrow loads of dirt per day for 690 years, how big does the hole get?
I'll have to get back to you on that, Saman said, grimacing. Most of the information on this topic is crap. What do you mean by that? Cray demanded.
We all looked at him, because in an instant he'd become markedly defensive.
Saman raised his eyes from the screen of the Jija and gazed interestedly at Cray. He let a few moments go by, then responded in a calm and matter-of-fact tone.
Anyone can post information on any topic. The vast majority of what's on the reticulum is, therefore, crap. It has to be filtered. The filtering systems are ancient. My people have been improving them and their interfaces since the time of the reconstitution. They are to us what the minster is to Fra Erasmus and his kind. When I look at a given topic, I don't just see information about that topic. I see meta-information that tells me what the filtering systems learned when they were conducting the search. If I look up Analemma, the filtering system tells me that only a few sources have provided information about this, and that they are mostly of high repute. They are avowed. If I look up the name of a popular music star who just broke up with her boyfriend, Saman continued, nodding at a tearful female on the spielie, the filtering system tells me that a vast amount of data has been posted on this topic quite recently, mostly of very low repute. When I look up the excavation of the Temple of Orithena on the island of Ekba, the filtering system informs me that people of very high and very low repute have been posting on this topic slowly but steadily for 7 centuries. Saman's explanation had failed if its purpose had been to settle Crade down. What's an example of a person of high repute? Some fra sitting in a consent?
Yes, Saman said.
And what would a low repute source be?
A conspiracy theorist, or anyone who makes a lot of long rambling posts that are only read by like-minded sorts.
A deolator?
That depends, Saman said.
On what the deolator is writing about?
What if he's writing about Ekba or Athena, the Teglon? Crade asked, whacking his index finger into a phototype that depicted the 10-sided plaza in front of the ancient temple.
The filters tell me that a lot has been posted in that vein, Saman said, as you appear to know very well. Sorting it out is difficult. When I see such a pattern emerging in the filter interface, my gut tells me that most of it is probably crap. It's a quick and superficial judgment. I could be wrong. I apologize if my choice of words offended you.
You're forgiven, Crade snapped. Well, I exclaimed, after a few moments' awkward silence had gone by. This has been fascinating. It's good that we figured this out before we wasted a lot of time searching the mountains. Obviously, the whole premise of my search for Orlo has changed. None of you imagined he would be going to the other side of the world, so you'll all want to turn around and head back south at this point.
Everyone just looked at me. None of their faces was readable.
Or so I imagine, I added.
This changes nothing, Saman said.
I'm not about to ditch my sib in this dump, Cord said.
You have to have 2 vehicles in case one breaks down in the cold, said Ganeliel Crade.
I couldn't argue with his logic, but I didn't for one moment think that this was his real reason for wanting to tag along. Not after he had let the word Teglon slip out.
From here to 83 North is 2,000 miles on a great circle route, said Saman, working his Jija. On the highway is 2,500 and some.
If you and Saman learn to drive, Raz, so that we can switch off, we can make it in 3 or 4 days, Crade said.
The road's bound to get worse as we go north, Cord said. I would plan on it taking a week.
Crade was eager to dispute that with her, but she added, and we'll have to modify the vehicles.
So we encamped in the fueling station's back lot and set to work. Once the proprietors understood that we were just passing through en route to the far north, they became more comfortable with us and things got easier. They assumed we were just another crew of vagabonds going up to mine the ruins, and better equipped and financed than most. The next day we used Cord's fetch to go out and buy new tires for Crade's. Then we used his to get tires for hers. The new tires were deeply grooved and had hobnails sticking out of them. Cord and Gunnell, as Gunnelio Craig now insisted we call him, worked together on some sort of tool-intensive project to replace the vehicle's coolants and lubricants with ones that would not freeze. Neither Saman nor I knew much about working on vehicles, so we stood around and tried to be useful. Saman used his Jija to study the route north, reading logs posted by travelers who had gone that way recently. "Hey," I said to him at one point, "my mind keeps going back to an image I saw in that Spiele feed yesterday."
"The burning librarian?"
"No."
"The mudslide hitting the school?"
"No."
"The brain-damaged boy playing with the puppies?"
"No."
"Okay, I give up."
"A rocket taking off." He looked at me.
"And what? Blowing up? Crashing into an orphanage?"
"No, that's the thing. It just took off."
"Did it have celebrities on board, or
not that they showed?" "They'd show that, wouldn't they?"
"I wonder why they bothered to show it then. Rockets take off all the time."
"Well, I'm no judge of these things, but it looked like an especially big one." For the first time, Saman seemed to take my meaning.
"I'll see what I can find," he said.
An elderly but bustling lady, one of Gunnell's co-religionists, came out with a cake that had been baked for us, then snared Gunnell in a conversation that never seemed to end. While they were talking, a big mud-splattered fetch with a wooden cabin on its back thundered into the fueling station, circled around us a couple of times, and claimed four parking spaces. The cake lady marched away, her face all pinched up. A big man with a beard shambled out of the cabin fetch and ambled toward Gunnell with his hands in his pockets, looking about curiously. When he got closer to Gunnell, he suddenly flashed a grin and extended his hand. Gunnell extended his after a moment's hesitation and let the other heave it up and down for a while. They spoke for no more than a few seconds, then the newcomer began to pace around our little encampment, taking a mental inventory of what we had and reconstructing in his mind what we'd been doing there. After a few minutes of that, he unfolded a sort of deployable counter from the side of his cabin on wheels and fired up a stove and began to make hot beverages for us.
"That's Ulasatar Kraid, my cousin," Gunnell told me as we watched him erect a little kitchen, blowing dust out of teacups and polishing pots with a rag from his pocket.
"What happened?" I asked.
"What are you talking about?" Gunnell asked, nonplussed.
"Well, it's obvious from the way that you and that lady react to him that there is some history, some kind of trouble between you."
Yula's here, Gunnell began,
and stopped himself before he had got to the end of the word.
"An apostate."
I wanted to ask, other than that, is he all right? But I let it drop.
Yul made no effort to introduce himself, but when I approached him, he turned to me with a smile and shook my hand before turning back to his chores. "Hold your arms out," he said.
And when I complied, he put a tray on them and then placed cups of hot stuff on the tray.
"For your friends," he said.
I insisted that he come with me, though. So after giving Gunnell a cup, we went over to Saman and I introduced the two of them. Then I talked Cord into sliding out from under her fetch. She stood up and dusted herself off and shook Yule's hand. They gave each other a funny look, which made me speculate that they might have crossed paths before. But neither one of them said anything about it. She accepted her cup, and then they turned away from each other as if something embarrassing had happened. Ulasatar Kraid gave me a lift into town so that I could run a couple of errands. First, I mailed my letter to Ayla, care of the consent of Sant Tredegar. The woman at the post office gave me a lot of trouble because it wasn't properly addressed. Consents didn't have addresses for the same reason that I didn't have a passport. I knew I'd made a terrible mistake by not giving some sort of note to Arcibald or Leo at the picnic in Samble. They could have smuggled it directly to Ayla. Instead of which, I had to mail this thing to the consent, where it would be intercepted by the hierarchs and, if they were sticking to the discipline, kept out of Ayla's knowledge until her next apert, more than 9 years from now. I could only imagine what she'd think of me at that time, reading this yellowed document written by a boy not yet 20 years of age. The next stop on the itinerary was a place where we could get suit sacks, huge orange coveralls whose legs could be zipped together to make them into sleeping bags. These were made for people who hunted or scavenged in the far north. Each had a catalytic power unit built into it. As long as you kept some fuel in its bladder, it would supply a modest trickle of power that was routed down the suit's arms and legs to warming pads placed in the soles of the boots and the palms of the mittens. New ones could be pretty expensive, but Yule had helped Orlo get a cheap one the other day. He knew of places where you could get used ones that had been fixed up, and he knew tricks for making them more comfortable. Once we had taken care of that, we set out in search of other gear and supplies we were going to need. Whenever I suggested going to an outdoorsy type of store, Yule winced and groaned, and then explained how better stuff could be had at 1/10 the price by using things you could buy at stores that sold housewares and groceries. He was always right, of course. He made his living as a wilderness guide, taking vacationers on trips to the mountains. Apparently, he had no work at the moment, because he spent the whole day driving me around Norsloth, helping me improvise what we needed. When we were unable to get what we wanted at a store, he promised to supply us out of his own personal stock. The driving consumed an unbelievable amount of time. The traffic was always bad, or so it seemed to me. But I wasn't used to the vehicular life of a city. When the traffic slowed to a stop, people in the mobs around us would look out the windows at Yule's ramshackle fetch. If they were grown-ups, they would soon look the other way, but children loved to point and stare and laugh, and they were right to do so. Yule and I were an odd pair compared to all of these people driving to school and to work. At first, Yule seemed to feel an obligation to be a good host, to provide entertainment during traffic jams.
Music?
He said distantly, as if music was something he had heard of once. Hearing no objection, he took to fiddling with the controls on his sound system as if they had broken off in his hands and were no longer attached to anything. Eventually, he left it set on a random feed. Later, once he got to talking, I reached over and turned it off, and he didn't notice. Part of his job, I guessed, was to make people he had just met, his clients, feel comfortable, which he did by telling stories. He was good at it. I tried to get him to talk about Orlo, but he didn't have much to say. Orlo might be a lot of things to me, but to Yule he was just another tenderfoot who needed advice on how to travel in the rough. This did, however, lead to the topic of getting around in the far north, which he knew a lot about. Later I asked him if all of his travel had been in that direction, and he scoffed and said that no, he had spent years as a river guide in a region south of Sambal that was gouged by deep sandstone canyons filled with spectacular rock formations. He told some good stories about such trips, but after a while became uncomfortable and stopped talking. Telling tales, it seemed, was a good way to loosen things up, a useful time killer. But what he really wanted was a project into which he could pour his energies and his intelligence. At some point during the day, he stopped referring to you, as in, you're going to need extra fuel in case you have to melt snow to make drinking water, and began speaking of we, as in, we should plan on at least 4 flat tires. Yule's house was really just a dumping ground for stuff he couldn't fit into his fetch. Camping equipment, vehicle parts, empty bottles, weapons, and books. The books were stacked in piles that came up to my hip. He didn't seem to own any shelves. A lot of them were fiction, but he also had several geology piles. Nailed to the wall were big blown-up phototypes of colorful sedimentary rock formations, sculpted by water and wind. In his cellar, where we went to mine more equipment, he had stacks of tabular rocks, slabs of sandstone, with fossils in them. After we had got everything he thought we'd need and begun driving through another traffic jam back to the fueling station, I said to him, "You figured out that the world was old, didn't you?"
"Yeah,"
he said immediately.
"I spent years on rafts going down those rivers. Years. The whole way, there's rocks strewn along the banks. Rocks the size of houses that fell out the canyon walls higher up. Just looking down one of those canyons, you can see it happens all the time."
"You mean rocks falling down?"
"Yeah. It's like if you're driving down this highway and you see skid marks on the pavement, like those right there. Any idiot knows that skidding happens. If you see lots of skid marks, well, that means that skidding is common. If you see lots of fallen rocks in a canyon, then rock falls are common. So I kept expecting to see one. Every day I'd be drifting down the river on that raft with the clients, you know, and they'd be sleeping or talking about whatever they wanted to talk about, and I'd keep an eye on the canyon walls waiting to see a rock fall.
But you never did.
Never. Not once.
So you realized that the timescale had to be enormous.
Yeah. I tried to figure it out once. I don't have the theorics. But I kept an eye on that river for 5 years and not a single rock fell down while I was running it. If Arbor is only 5,000 years old, if all the rocks in that canyon have fallen down in that short a time, I should have seen some rocks fall.
The people in your arc didn't like what you had to say about that, I guessed.
There's a reason I got out of Sambal.
That was the end of that conversation. It was the evening rush hour now, and we drove in silence for a long time. I was fascinated by the little glimpses of other people's lives that I got through the windows of their mobs. Then I was struck by how different Yule's life seemed to be from theirs. The way in which Yule had decided to join us on our journey north was strange to me. There had been no rational process, no marshaling of evidence, no weighing of options. But that was how Yule lived his whole life. He had not, I realized, been invited by Gunnell to come out and pay us a visit at the fueling station. He had just shown up. He did a new thing with a new set of people every day of his life, and that made him just as different from the people in the traffic jam as I was. So I looked with fascination at those people in their mobs and tried to fathom what it would be like. Thousands of years ago, the work that people did had been broken down into jobs that were the same every day, in organizations where people were interchangeable parts. All of the story had been bled out of their lives. That was how it had to be. It was how you got a productive economy. But it would be easy to see a will at work behind this. Not exactly an evil will, but a selfish will. The people who had made the system thus were jealous, not of money and not of power, but of story. If their employees came home at day's end with interesting stories to tell, it meant that something had gone wrong. A blackout, a strike, a spree killing. The powers that be would not suffer others to be in stories of their own unless they were fake stories that had been made up to motivate them. People who couldn't live without story had been driven into the consents or into jobs like Yule's. All others had to look somewhere outside of work for a feeling that they were part of a story, which I guessed was why seculars were so concerned with sports and with religion. How else could you see yourself as part of an adventure? Something with a beginning, middle, and end in which you played a significant part. We Avowed had it ready-made because we were part of this project of learning new things. Even if it didn't always move fast enough for people like Jessery, it did move. You could tell where you were and what you were doing in that story. Yule got all of this for free by living his stories from day to day, and the only drawback was that the world held his stories to be of small account. Perhaps that was why he felt such a compulsion to tell them, not just about his own exploits in the wilderness, but those of his mentors. We at last reached the fueling station. Yule deployed his traveling kitchen and began to make supper. He made no formal announcement that he was coming with us, but this was obvious from the way he talked, and so after a while, Gunnell went into the station and struck a deal with the management for Cord to leave her fetch parked there for a couple of weeks. Cord began to move things from her fetch into Yule's. As he cooked, Yule observed this procedure closely and soon began to complain, in a joking way, about the enormous volume of unnecessary clutter that Cord was, according to him, stuffing into his home on wheels. Cord soon began to volley the abuse back at him. Within about 60 seconds, they were saying amazingly rude things to each other. I couldn't take part in their banter any more than I could get between two persons who were kissing or fighting, so I drifted over to Saman.
"I found that rocket spuli," he told me. "You were right about its being big. That's one of the largest rockets going nowadays."
"Anything else?"
"The payload," he said. "Its shape and size match those of a vehicle that is generally used to carry humans into space."
"How many humans?"
"Up to 8.
"Well, is there any information about who is on board or why they're going up there?" Saman shook his head.
"Not unless you count the absence of information as information."
"What do you mean by that?"
"According to the powers that be, the vehicle is unmanned. It's a test of a new system under SINDEV control."
I gave him a look. He grinned and held up his hands.
I know. I've made inquiries on a few reticules known to me. In a few days, maybe, we'll have something.
In a few days, we'll be at the North Pole.
In a few days, he said, that might be a wise place to be.
The next morning, after a large breakfast prepared by Yule and Cord, we started the journey north. Cord's fetch stayed behind. Our caravan consisted of the Crade vehicles, that of Yulasitar containing most of the gear, that of Ganeliel carrying his three-wheeler in the back. The first leg was north and downhill to the coastal plain, a turn to the right when we neared salt water, and then a long sweeping leftward curve as we skirted a gulf of the Northern Ocean. At the head of that gulf lay what had been the greatest port in the world for a couple of centuries back in the first millennium AR, when the water had stayed ice-free all year round. Because of its location, it had later become the shallowest of all ruins, the easiest to mine. Most of its great works, its viaducts, seawalls, and bridges, had been hammered apart by scavengers who had extracted the reinforcing bars buried in the synthetic stone and shipped the metal to places where it was needed. The rubble mounds were forested with immense trees. The only remaining structure from that age was a suspension bridge over the great river that emptied into the head of the gulf. It was high enough above sea level that the resurgent pack ice had not crushed it. At this time of year, there was no ice to be seen, but it was easy to make out the scars it had left along the rubble banks. This port ruin now functioned as a fishing village and Drummond stop. A few hundred people lived here, at least in the summer. Once we left it behind and struck inland, heading almost due north, we saw only scattered settlements, which thinned and failed as we climbed into forested hills. We then descended into an unmistakably different landscape. Taiga, a country too dry and cold for trees to grow much higher than a person's head. Almost all traffic had vanished from the highway. We drove for an hour without seeing any other vehicles. Finally, we stopped in a rocky place near a river, pulled our vehicles round to where they couldn't be seen from the road, and slept in our suit sacks. The next morning, the brand new stove we had bought after leaving Sambal stopped working. If Yule hadn't joined us, we'd have spent the rest of the trip eating cold energy bars. Yule, looking quietly triumphant, produced a thunderous breakfast on his battery of roaring industrial burners. Watching his cousin work, Ganel seemed proud, if exasperated, as if to say, "Look at what fine people we can produce when they stop believing in our religion." Since there was almost no traffic on the road, I took driving lessons from Yule while Cord dismantled the stove. She diagnosed the problem as a clogged orifice, attributable to gunk that had precipitated from the fuel during the cold night. "You're fuming," she pointed out a while later. I realized that I had withdrawn from the conversation. She and Yule had been talking, but I hadn't heard a word of their conversation. "What is the problem?" "I just can't believe that in this day and age we are having a problem with chemical fuel," I said. "Sorry, we should have bought the premium brand." "No, it's not that. Nothing for you to be sorry about. I'm just pointing out that this stove is 4,000-year-old praxis." Cord was nonplussed. "Same goes for this fetch and everything in it," she said.
"Hey!"
Yule cried, mock wounded. Cord scoffed, rolled her eyes, and turned her attention back to me. "Everything except for your sphere, that is. So? I guess because I live in a place with almost zero praxis, it never occurs to me to think about such things," I said. "But at times like this, the absurdity hits me between the eyes. There's no reason to put up with junk like this. A stove with dangerous, unreliable chemical fuel? With orifices that clog? In 4,000 years, we could have made a better stove. Would I be able to take that stove apart and fix it? You wouldn't have to, because it would never break. But I want to know if I could understand such a stove." "You're the kind of person who could probably understand just about anything if you set your mind to it." "Nice flattery, Raz, but you keep dodging the question." "All right. I take your point. You're really asking if the average person could understand the workings of such a thing. I don't know what an average person is. But look at Yule here. He built this fetch himself. Didn't you, Yule?" Yule was uneasy that Cord had suddenly made this conversation about him, but he deferred to her. He glanced away and nodded.
"Yep, got the burners from scavengers, welded up the frame."
"And it worked," Cord said. "I know," I said, and patted my belly. "No, I mean the system worked, Cord insisted. What system? She was exasperated. The
non-system, Yul said. The lack of a system.
Yul knew that stoves like this were unreliable, Cord said, nodding at the broken one. He had learned that from experience.
Oh, bitter experience, my girl,
Yul proclaimed. He ran into some scavengers who had found better burner heads in a ruin up north, haggled with them, figured out a way to hook them up. Probably has been tinkering with them ever since.
Took me 2 years to make it run right,
Yul admitted. And none of that would have been possible with some kind of technology that only an avout can understand, Cord concluded. Okay, okay, I said, and let it drop there. Letting the argument play out would have been a waste of breath. We, the Theors, who'd retreated, or depending on how you liked your history, been herded into the maths at the Reconstitution, had the power to change the physical world through praxis. Up to a point, ordinary people liked the changes we made. But the more clever the praxis became, the less people understood it and the more dependent they became on us. And they didn't like that at all. Cord spent a while telling Yul what she knew about the cousins and about all that had happened during the journey from St. Edhar to Sambal to Norsluf. Yul took it pretty calmly, which irked me. I wanted to grab him by the shoulders and shake him and make him see, somehow, that this was an event of cosmic significance, the most important thing that had ever happened. But he listened to Cord's narration as if she were relating a story of how she had fixed a flat tire on her way to work. Perhaps it was a habit of wilderness guides to feign unnatural calm when people ran up to them with upsetting news. Anyway, it gave me an opening to carry forward the stove argument in a way that wouldn't make Cord so irritated. When the conversation lapsed, I tried, I see why you guys, or anyone, would feel more comfortable with a stove you could take apart and understand, and I'm fine with that, normally. But these are not normal times. If the cousins turn out to be hostile, how can we oppose them? Because it looks like they came from a world that didn't have anything like the Reconstitution.
A dictatorship of the Theors,
Yul said. It doesn't have to be a dictatorship. If you could see how Theors behave in private, you'd know they could never be that organized. But Cord was of one mind with Yul on this. Once they get to the point where they're building ships like that one, she said, it is a dictatorship in effect. You said yourself it would take the resources of a whole planet. How do you think they got their hands on those resources? In most cases, Cord and I saw things the same way, and the extra avout split simply was not important to us, so when she talked this way, it made me more upset than I cared to let on. I let it drop for a while. On these endless drives, it was nothing to let the conversation pause for an hour or two. And there was something else going on, which was that everything had changed about Cord when Yul had showed up. These two simply knew what to do around each other. Whatever was going on between them, I wasn't part of it, and I felt jealous. We passed through another ruined city, almost as shallow as yesterday's and almost as thoroughly erased. The cousins' praxis is nothing to jump up and down about, I said. We haven't seen anything on that ship that couldn't have been built in our own praxic age. That makes me think that we could build a weapon that could disable their ship. Cord smiled, and the tension was gone. You sound like Fraud Jad the other day, she exclaimed, with obvious affection. For me. Oh, really? What did the old man say? I could hear the hurt draining out of my own speech. She adopted a pretty good imitation of his grumbling voice.
Their electrical systems could be disabled by a burst of Hoosamajigger fields.
Then Leo said,
Begging your pardon, Fraud Jad, but we don't know how to make those.
Why, it's simple. Just build a frastic array of what's-it-field inducers.
Sorry, Fraud Jad, but no one studies those theorics anymore. And it takes 30 years' study to get up to speed.
And so on. I laughed. But then, tallying the days in my head, I realized something. They're probably reaching Tredegar right now. Probably starting to talk about how to make those what's-it-field inducers. I would hope so. The secular power probably has tons of information about the cousins that has been withheld from us until now. Maybe they've even been going up there and talking to the cousins. I'll bet they are giving all that information to the Frost and Sewers at the Convox.
Oh, I wish I was there. I'm tired of not understanding. Instead, I'm helping Fraud Jed understand why a throwback wants to visit a 7th-century-old archaeological dig.
I slapped the control panel helplessly.
Hey!
Yule said in mock outrage, and pretended to haul off and punch me in the shoulder.
Oh, I guess that's part of being a pawn, I went on.
Your vision of what the Convox is like sounds pretty romantic to me, Cord said. Way too optimistic. Remember the first day at the machine hall when we were trying to get 17 people into 6 vehicles?
Vividly.
This Convox thing is probably like that, except 1,000 times worse.
Unless there's someone like me there,
Yule said.
You should see the way I can get 17 tourists into 4 rafts.
Well, Yule's not at Tredegar, Cord pointed out. So you're not missing a thing. Just relax and enjoy the drive.
Okay, I said, and laughed a little. Your understanding of human nature is better than mine.
What's your problem with me, then?
Yule demanded. As the drive went on, most of us bounced back and forth between the 2 vehicles. The exception was Ganel, who always remained in his fetch, though sometimes he'd let Saman drive it. The next day, when Cord and I were alone together for a couple of hours, she told me that she and Yule had become boyfriend and girlfriend.
Huh,
I said. I guess that explains why you two spend so much time out gathering firewood. I wasn't trying to be a smarty pants, just trying to emulate the kind of banter that Cord and Yule exchanged so freely. But Cord became quite embarrassed, and I realized that I had struck too close to home. I groped around for something else to say.
Well, now that you've told me, it seems like it was meant to be. I guess I just didn't see it because I had this idea that you were going out with Rosk.
Cord thought that was pretty silly. Remember all those conversations I was having with him on my G-Jaw the other day?
Yes.
Well, what we were really doing was breaking up. Well, Cord, I hate to be a pedantic avout, but I couldn't help overhearing your half of those conversations, and I don't think I heard a single word that was even remotely about breaking up. She looked at me as if I were insane. All I'm saying, I said, holding up my hands, is that I had no idea that that was what was going on.
Neither did I, Cord said.
Do you think... I began and stopped. I'd been about to say, do you think that Rosk knows? But I realized in the nick of time that it would be suicide. It seemed to me like a pretty irregular way to handle important relationships, but then I remembered how things had gone with me and Ayla, and decided I was in no position to criticize my sib on that score. Cord and I had talked surprisingly little about our family. That is, the family that I had shared with her until I'd gone the clock. But what little I'd heard had left me amazed by how clever people were at finding ways to make each other crazy and miserable, whether it was those they were related to or a crowd of strangers they'd been thrown together with in a consent. Cord sometimes seemed 80 years old in her knowledge and experience and cynicism about such things. I couldn't help thinking she'd thrown up her hands at some point and decided to devote the rest of her life to mastering things such as machines that could be made sense of and fixed. No wonder she hated the idea of machines she couldn't understand. And no wonder she didn't waste a lot of time trying to understand things she couldn't. Like why she was now Yule's girlfriend.